This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to this Clash of the Titles Christmas Countdown Special! Ho, ho, ho! Merry Christmas, everyone!
Welcome to this Christmas Clash of the Titles, the podcast that sees two movies with something in common go head-to-head to see which one does it better. On this Christmas Countdown Special, in the red corner. Are we getting too old for this? Is this getting too old for us? And how bad can one woman's cooking really be? We'll answer these questions and more as we spend some time with one of cinema's greatest ever cop duos, Riggs and Merton. It's the Christmas classic, 1987's Lethal Weapon.
He's the criminal's worst nightmare. A cop who enjoys the danger. He was ready to retire. Now, he's gonna wish he had.
Raj, meet your new partner.
New partner? Too old for this.
While in the blue corner, how can the same shit happen to the same guy twice for the very first time? Yes! It's the movie that turned TV actor Bruce Willis into a movie star and gave us one of action cinema's greatest ever villains. We're saying yippee-ki-yay with John McClane in 1988's Die Hard.
It's Christmas Eve in L.A.
California.
Is Daddy coming home soon?
Well, we'll see what Santa and Mommy can do, okay?
A New York cop, John McClane, has come to see his wife.
I missed you.
Instead, he's going to have to save her.
Sit down.
So, what connects these two films, and which one does it better? Let's find out. It's Clash of the Titles.
Release the Kraken!
Hello, Clash Putters! What did one shepherd say to the other shepherd? Let's get the flock out of here. I'm Alex Zane.
I'm Vicky Crompton.
I'm Chris Tilly.
And welcome to this week's Christmas Cop Clash, as Lethal Weapon goes up against Die Hard to decide which is the greatest Christmas action movie ever. These were my choices. Oh, as always, you're welcome. Okay, good. And also, why are we doing these movies? Well, because it's simply not Christmas in my book until you watch Die Hard, Lethal Weapon, or a combination of the two. All right, I actually have something special to do. Before we get into this show properly, I got something special to do.
I think I know what this is going to be.
I think you do. I thought he would as well. Hello. Oh, is that the sexy sound of Tupperware opening on Clash of the Titles? Oh, it is. What could these foil-wrapped things possibly be? There you go, Victoria.
Thank you.
There you go, Christopher.
What is this, Alex?
Oh, I don't know.
Why do you know and I don't?
Because we've talked about it a bunch of times on the show and he promised us this last year and didn't deliver.
No, it's not! Oh. No, it's it! Oh, my God, it's me!
For listeners who might not know, though, yeah. Alex, do you want to...
This is my gift to you from another person. This is... The Christmas Tom Cruise cake. It was delivered to my house, to me, from Tom Cruise yesterday. This is my third or fourth year in a row. Who's keeping score?
Did you invite him in for a cup of tea?
No, I was busy, actually. I was watching Die Hard, but he'd seen it too many times, so he just handed me the cake.
Lovely. It looks lovely.
We can't eat on a podcast. That's the law, isn't it?
So I wasn't sure whether it would be great, because this would be like the live eating of a Tom Cruise Christmas cake. I'm going to have a bite.
Okay.
Just one bite.
And then can this be part of our substantial meal in the pub outdoors afterwards?
I really hope so. I think yes.
Oh, it's good.
Is it really good? Oh, all right, I'm gonna have
some. Oh my God, it's good.
Oh, thank you, Tom.
Thanks, Tom.
How many movie podcasts can say that their host ate a cake from Tom Cruise live on air?
What is it? Has it got coconut in it?
It's got coconut in it.
That's incredible.
Really nice.
It's amazing. It's a great cake.
I got Al Pacino sent me some sausage meat. And Susan Sarandon sent me a chocolate log, so they'll be coming in next week.
All right, that's that bit done. I'm really glad I did it.
Thank you, Alex. Thank you, Tom.
Back to the show. No clues for our Christmas countdown shows, because we've announced what the pairings are. But that doesn't mean there isn't one hell of a party going on our Twitter at ClashPod, which you are all invited to, or want to be one of the first to join our new Instagram, also at ClashPod. So no guesses, but I'm just going to do a bit of a shout out to a few names. Dave Flower, I Am Grout, Andrew Holden, Andy Gaffney, Josie Bob. There's loads more. I can't do the whole list, but thank you for all your kind words about our Love Actually show, which seemed to go down a treat last week. Who knew you could be so angry on a podcast and it'd be great listening?
It's a relief, actually.
Yeah. Shall we do the connections between Die Hard and Lethal Weapon? Because there are many.
Mm-hmm.
Who'd like to start?
People or things? What do you want to go with?
I've sort of just mashed them all together in one unholy list, which I'm probably going to have to edit on air because it's too long.
Well, you've got to start with a big one, Joel Silver, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Uber producer, and this takes him up to this week takes him up to 7 Clash Pods, Commando, Roadhouse, Demolition Man, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, Nice Guys, and these two movies.
Nice. I'll go with Christmas Cocaine. It'll kill you by either being cut with dry cleaner or making you overconfident in your negotiating skills.
I'd also say there's so much cocaine floating around these film sets that I got high watching it.
Victoria.
I've got, are you a white police officer? I bet you don't play by the rules. Are you a black police officer? I bet you're a family man.
It's good. Thanks. It's true. It's true. I like stunts involving helicopters being too close to the ground.
Vietnam vets.
Mm.
All over these movies.
I want a cigarette. Repeatedly.
people falling out of skyscrapers.
Yeah. I've got inappropriate rain. So in an ending of one of the versions of Lethal Weapon, there's a trailer truck full of cocaine and it explodes over the Hollywood Hills. So it sort of snows coke over the Hollywood side.
This was in the original script.
Yeah. Right. And then at the end of Die Hard, isn't it the money? It is money, isn't it, raining down? Like big banker's drafts.
Barabonds.
What is that?
I don't know.
Yeah. Anyway, inappropriate rain.
Yep. Michael Kamen.
Oh, composer. Yep, sure.
We know him from Roadhouse and Robin Hood.
Yeah. Let's talk about old TV shows a lot. We've got The Lone Ranger.
Yeah.
Is it The Lone Ranger with Roy Rogers? That was The Lone Ranger, wasn't it? Yes, The Lone Ranger. And then we've also got, what is it? The Three Stooges. Jeez, I should have written that down.
Grand Bush.
Mmm.
What a name. I really like saying it. Grand Bush.
Grand Bush. I can see. He plays Detective Boyette in Lethal Weapon, but you will know him as Agent Johnson in the helicopter who isn't Robert Davey.
Oh, right, yeah.
Little Johnson.
Little Johnson,
yeah,
there
okay,
you go.
Yep. Yeah.
Mary Ellen Traynor.
Mm.
Again.
Yep, Zemeckis' wife at the time. She's in both films. As is our old friend.
Yep.
Do you want to say him?
Al Long is there as Endo the Torturer and Candy Bar Eating Thief.
So we've had him on Big Chum, Little China, They Live, and Bill and Ted. So he's up to 5 now.
Bruce Willis?
Yeah.
Are we having Bruce Willis as a connection?
Can do.
I mean, he was in Loaded Weapon 1, which was a spoof of Lethal Weapon. He had a cameo as John McClane in that, so I guess he's a connection.
Kind of, yeah.
Sort of.
The way the big blonde villain gets shot at the end is very similar in both movies.
Mm. Yeah.
It's a very similar moment.
It is, because what is it?
Al Powell does it in one of them, and Murtaugh does it in the other.
Yeah, but Bruce Willis and his wife are sort of draped in a big coat that they're sharing as Riggs and Murtaugh are. Mm-hmm. And now, yeah, I'll go with that. I've got one to end on, so okay. If we've got any more, this is my last one. Cheryl Baker.
Yes.
Have you got it?
I didn't know. We've talked about her before.
Yeah, we have, in Roadhouse.
Yes, she was well-endowed woman in Roadhouse. That was her credit.
Yeah, I only got into this because I saw the credit and I did my time working out, and it was around the time Eggs and Baker was on TV.
Yeah.
And I did want to know if it was Cheryl Baker.
I thought that's who you, that's why I've gone quiet.
Of Eggs and Baker fame.
That is who you mean. Yeah.
It's not her.
No, it's
not her. No, but
we've discussed well-endowed woman before.
Right. Mm.
Yeah, so she is in Lethal Weapon. She's credited as Girl in Shower. And then in Die Hard, she stars as Woman. And then in Roadhouse, which we discussed, she was well-endowed wife. And she bowed out of acting after 1991's LA Story, where she played Changing Room Woman.
Yeah, she's had enough of this.
I think so. Yeah. I think if you've gone from Girl in Shower to Changing Room Woman, you've just moved on in life.
But to go from Lethal Weapon to Die Hard to Roadhouse, I think she might have been involved with someone producing this movie.
Mm. Yeah. Still a legendary trio of movies to have on your CV, regardless of what your credit is within them. That's good. Very quickly, before we crack on, I did mention Loaded Weapon, which has a cameo from Bruce Willis. That also starred an actor by the name of Tim Curry. And that completes this week's obligatory Tim Curry reference.
Oh, an actual good one.
Yeah, a good one this week.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it fell in my lap, I won't lie. So, V, I gave you Lethal Weapon. Chris, I gave you Die Hard. So, you're already both winners. But we do it chronologically, meaning 1988's Die Hard is on Thursday. But today, it's Lethal Weapon. Victoria, take us on a journey.
Lethal Weapon stars Mel Gibson as a deranged and sad, frequently naked and wildly mulleted cop, partnered with Danny Glover's fully shirted and tied regular guy. A guy who loves his family so much, he spends a lot of time hiding from them on a boat in his driveway. Anyway, this pair have got to solve the drugs-related death of some people or something. It doesn't really matter, as the action takes a backseat to the blossoming friendship between Riggs and Murtaugh. As each learns from the other, Riggs finding a reason to stay alive and Murtaugh rediscovering the fire in his belly from his youth, because don't forget he's 50 in this film, which we are repeatedly told is ancient. And it all culminates in those classic demonstrations of platonic love, where you say to someone, I see you, you're my friend, I've got you, so let's drive a car through the front of my house for no fucking reason, and you can have a semi-naked mud wrestle to the death on the lawn.
Funny.
It's good.
So controversially, I've only seen this film once before in the week. I don't know why. I just have. But... yeah, and I look at your face.
No, that was me acknowledging the fact that I don't remember when I first saw it either. It's just one of those films that I've obviously seen more than once.
Yeah.
But I don't remember having that sort of like epiphany. I know I loved it when I first saw it, but I don't know when it was.
I just don't know why I haven't seen it again. I don't know. It just didn't fall onto the list.
What Alex said. But also, I would say, you know, contrary to what you said at the start there, Alex, I don't tend to watch this Christmas time in the way that I watch Die Hard. Mm. This hasn't become a Christmas favourite for me. Mm. It's an action film I've watched a few times at this time, and also the sequels you would watch. They all kind of melded into one in those sort of 10 years.
I genuinely used to get Lethal Weapon 2 and 1 confused.
Yeah, for sure.
All the time.
Mm. Which is fine.
Yeah,
let's not do it today.
No, of course.
So yeah, it's just always been there.
Yeah.
But this is why I was more excited about, of the two films, I was more excited about watching Lethal Weapon for this show.
Sure.
Purely because, and I can't believe I'm saying this, but I think I may have watched Die Hard too much.
Agreed.
There was a small part of me this time that when I put it on, I was like, I know every beat of this movie so well. I've watched it almost annually for like my entire life. And not my entire life, but ever since it came out. And I'm a bit sort of like, here we go. And then I got into it and it was fine. But Lethal Weapon was the one I was excited about.
Okay. So shall we talk about the background to this much loved classic?
Do it.
Let's do it.
So Shane Black, my would-be boyfriend and friend of the podcast now.
on what grounds? Just because you like him a lot?
No, because this is his third film.
I'm right.
Is that right?
Fine.
Or fourth? Monster Squad. Yep. Yeah.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
That's
yeah.
what I'm going to say, friend of the pod. I mean, that not because I like him now.
Yeah.
I have gone on a journey with that man. But
yeah,
you,
you did a whole speech about reading his hero speech and falling in love with him.
I honestly did, because that interview I read with him, where he was just modest and wise, and he wasn't what I expected from what I'd read about his lifestyle, which is really judgmental of me.
Yeah, and watching his movies.
Well, yeah, exactly. To be fair to me.
I know someone who worked with him when he was going through all the party period. And I think he is a better person now than he was then,
yeah.
is how I would put it.
It depends on you, mate. It depends on your opinion on what makes a better person.
True, that's true, yeah. So this is the story. A year after he graduated from UCLA, he apparently wrote Lethal Weapon in 6 weeks. It was his second screenplay. So one of his friends, Fred Decker, who Shane Black wrote his first screenplay with, called Shadow Company, helps him find an agent. His agent sends it to Joel Silver, and then they develop the script together. So Shane Black wanted to write an urban Western inspired by Dirty Harry because of his great love of character-driven films like that and The French Connection and Bullet. What I've read around, like, descriptions of his writing and how this film sort of set the template for buddy cop movies, but also for his own style of writing. I saw a description of his writing as frisky, like not as in horny, but as in like energetic. And mm-hmm. I think that is such a good, apt description of his writing.
I'd agree with that.
So in 1986, Warner Brothers paid $250,000 for it, which is a lot of money now. It was a lot of money then. And they gave it to Richard Donner. Apparently Leonard Nimoy was considered for it, but he was doing Three Men and a Baby, so I had to turn it down. Bruce Willis was almost cast. We know this, don't we? Like, is that one of those things that's not true?
No, but... it's just there's so many casting rumors. Like, and I think it was probably more true that Mel Gibson was almost cast as John McClane in Die Hard than the other way around. Mm. But yeah, very possibly.
Yeah, okay. But obviously the part of Riggs goes to Mel Gibson, and then Danny Glover comes on board after Richard Donner screen tested two of them together, and they've just got this unbelievable chemistry. He said they found tears where they didn't exist before, and more importantly, they found a relationship all in just one reading. So then you've got your duo. And that's about as much as I've done really on the background, unless you want to talk about other casting stuff, because those two are this film, I've kind of left it there. Any more?
No, not really. I remember watching 20 Feet from Stardom, the Oscar-winning documentary, and I was fascinated about Darlene Love, who plays Roger Murtaugh's wife, Mrs. Murtaugh, the one with the bad cooking.
Yeah.
And she's got a fascinating story, which it's probably for an entirely different podcast, but may I suggest that if you're interested in her life story, watch 20 Feet from Stardom, because she worked with Phil Spector, and she was like a ghost singer for a lot of artists in her youth, and... Yeah, she's this hugely well-respected singer.
She's one of my favourite singers, and she recorded one of the great Christmas songs, Christmas Baby Please Come Home, which was used very well in Gremlins.
Mm, yeah. But beyond that, I just wanted to give her a bit of a mention because, you know, it's always funny when you go, oh, she's not just his wife in this movie.
No, she did all sorts of other stuff. Amazing.
She's got an excuse not to be a good cook.
Her meatloaf or whatever. It's roused. Anyway, so let's talk about the film, shall we?
Yes.
Okay, let's just go through some of the fun bits. So we open with a very pretty lady.
Well, let's rewind.
What?
We open with, I'm not going to let it pass, one of the sexiest fonts in the history of opening titles.
Yeah,
doesn't that font just, it's a time capsule, that font. You're like, oh, here we are. Yep. It is 1987, baby. Look at that blue fading into that white. Look at the way it arrives on screen. God, I love this movie already.
To go from the font into the saxophone and guitar combo, it's filth.
And very soon it really is.
It really is, because our lovely lady, she's got beautiful earrings on, but no bra. And that's how you know that something's not quite right.
She is a one-woman party, though.
You know, she's having a lovely time.
She's having a great time.
Seemingly all
she
alone.
She doesn't need anyone there. She's got her Coke. She's got her negligee. She's loving life.
She is. So this is Amanda. Now, it pains me to say things like this, so I won't be too arch, but because of my deep love for Shane Black's writing, there are moments in this script I was like, oh, come on now, because... This is Amanda, as I've said, but if you miss that, someone is going to tell you this frequently throughout the film, so you do not miss anybody's relationship to anybody else. So, and I find that just a bit jarring. Like, I like to be able to make, you know, I can fill in the gaps by myself, but whatever, it's fine. It's a little thing.
He does love opening a movie with someone dead with their boobs out, though, doesn't he?
Specifically a porn star.
Yes.
And actually, rewatching this made me like the Nice Guys less, I think, because that scene at the beginning of Nice Guys has never really sit right with me. I think it's an odd one. And then to realise he's done it twice, for shock value, he's killed a half-naked porn star in his opening scene. It's like, come on, Shane.
Although both of them sort of do land in their death position, which could easily be the January photo of their next year's calendar.
Which is problematic.
Yeah, it is.
Why have you said that?
Because
that's
it's worth pointing out.
Well, it's done
out.
On purpose, I think. Yeah. It's very odd and I don't like it, but... Yeah.
And also from a script point of view, Amanda dies jumping from a building.
Yeah, or after she's done a lot of cocaine, she has one hell of a nasty come down.
Oh, very good.
Thank you.
But the mystery of the jump is resolved really quickly. So there's actually no point to her jumping if you're going to tie that all up super quick within the next 5 minutes, which is she would have died anyway because she had drain cleaner in her
system. I feel like it's unnecessarily complicated.
Yeah.
The fact that she was going to die anyway, but she jumped.
Yeah, so it's, why do we need to see that?
For a first-time watch, that's a really confusing thing to get your head around.
Yeah, but what is more of a holy fuck opening that someone sort of slowly going, oh, I don't feel well. That cocaine was not cocaine. Uh-oh. And dead. Or... falling 30 stories to the ground. That's an opening.
But these guys, and we're going to get to Shadow Company, which was the name of that script that he carried over. You know, they are trained killer experts. They pick very weird and unnecessarily complicated ways to kill people. Yeah. The drain killer in the cocaine, and then there's a, you know, there's a chopper at a funeral later, and it's like,
the chopper
guys,
at the
just
funeral.
Just shoot someone. You guys are soldiers.
Just pick a lock, go in quietly, shoot them with a silencer, and leave.
Yeah, and also because they don't even do it themselves. They employ Dixie.
They do.
They employ Dixie.
So they could have got Dixie to literally push her off that building. Job done. You get the same spectacular moment, and she still murdered her on their behalf.
Yeah. So are we assuming that Amanda was troubled anyway and was going to kill herself? Because
no,
if that's the case, then the whole drain labor, they were like, we should have just fucking left her to it. Like, the drain cleaner has left a clue that something was afoot. If she was going to jump anyway.
Yeah, that's true. It just tapped into the, do you remember when you were growing up? And there was this idea, if you take drugs, you'll think you can fly.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep. No, is that from this?
That's acid, though. Surely that
is
was
acid.
Just acid.
There's one person once on acid stepped off a ledge.
And I also think that the parents who didn't know the ways and wherefores of drugs thought that getting high as well, it was all combined that you could think you could fly because you're high. And
you were literally high off the ground. Yeah, okay, that makes sense. But yeah, I just assume that years and years of being told you'll think you can fly, which isn't true, comes from Lethal Weapon. Anyway, so Amanda's dead.
That actress, by the way, Jackie Swanson, she married Woody on Cheers. She played like the most innocent character in all of TV.
Oh, she didn't marry Woody Harrelson in real life. She married Woody's character, Woody in Cheers.
On Cheers.
On Cheers.
Oh, really? Yeah,
so was she a recurring character on it then?
Yeah.
Oh, well. Yeah.
I didn't recognise her.
I just know her from Amanda and Friends.
Right. So anyway, Amanda's death sets the game afoot and we're going to meet our heroes, our cops. So we've got Danny Glover. He's a family man. Mel Gibson smokes in bed and walks about naked.
Okay.
And see, I'm pointing at you because given your weird horror of sleeping naked, but you love smoking. Mm. How do you feel about this as a setup?
So I've got two things. There is no doubt smoking is perceived as cool in this era and these films. I genuinely have never seen a hero wake up. He wakes up with a half-smoked cigarette in his mouth. Is he sleep smoking? Has he put that in his mouth and started smoking? Because it's not, he's like, he goes, oh, I'm awake. Oh, I'm smoking.
Oh,
hello.
Yeah.
But of the two intros, so we've got Mel Gibson waking up. Riggs wakes up and he's got a cigarette in his mouth and he's repulsively naked. And yes, it's a big red flag for me in terms of relating to this character, because I'm like, just boxer shorts, trunks.
Anything.
Yeah, anything. When I say trunks, you know, sort of cotton trunks, not swimming trunks. And then he steps up and he immediately opens a beer. And I'm like, this is great. I love this. Obviously, to an audience, this is a signal that he's a troubled man.
Mm-hmm.
I would argue that the person who has a more troubling situation is Danny Glover.
Mm.
Because how close is that family that they think it's okay to raid his bathroom with a birthday cake when he is naked in the bath? Now, of the people at the start of this movie who we should consider whether they're wearing trunks or not, you've got to hope he's got trunks on in that bath because there are not enough bubbles, and that is his adult daughter.
His dick is floating.
The thing is, I was about to be like, that's his kids, it's fine. There is a moment when his daughter comes down the stairs and she's wearing like, is it a prom dress or a new dress or something?
Yeah.
And the way he looks at her is like he was sexually flustered by her. Do you not think?
Doesn't he ask her for some sugar in this scene?
Probably. What? I mean, what he should say is, get the fuck out, I'm in the bath.
Yeah, but he's got little kids as well. Why I think he's all right.
Why is he having a bath before work?
Yeah, a bath's an end of the day thing.
It is. Well, because people didn't have showers in the 80s. That's not true, is it? The 80s was big on... It's when showers were invented, isn't it?
You're from the 80s.
But the thing is, I remember my parents buying our electric shower from a door-to-door salesman. And prior to that moment, we had no shower. So we had baths.
It seemed to me at the start of this conversation about his family storming the bathroom that you were kind of okay with it.
Yeah.
Aren't you?
The thing is...
If Mark was in the bath, would it be all right for you and the kids to go in?
Yeah, of course it would.
Now I find that weird.
You find nakedness weird.
No, I think the little kids, when the daughter who looks about 21, when she, yeah, that's making me a bit uncomfortable.
Because she gives him a kiss on the lips as well. And if you're in the bath and you're naked... And
your dick's floating.
Do they float?
Yeah.
Well, they just detach.
They don't detach. They don't detach, but they...
Like a bath toy.
They float up to the top.
Sometimes you can leave the bathroom and go, oh, shit, you know, I've forgotten. And
like my dick in the
you have to go back before it goes down the plug hole. And for some people, not me, though. It wouldn't fit.
And they've come in for his 50th birthday.
Oh dear.
It'd just be lying there sort
like
of
a straw on the just going.
Not mine, some.
They've come in for his 50th birthday, Alex.
Mm.
But he was 40 when they shot this.
Yeah.
Making you and I older than the guy who was too old for this shit.
Yes, yeah.
How messed up is that? We are older than Murtaugh.
But I think ages have changed, haven't they, over the years? Because 50 is a new 40, 40 is a new 30. Yeah, but in this film, he's really meant to be like on his last legs. He's like, I am 50
he's
years
40
old.
40 years
this
old.
This is what I am done for. I found that I'm looking at 40.
Because that actress who plays his daughter, he's actually, in real life, he's only 14 years older than her.
Really?
Yeah.
What's, oh, really?
She's older than she's playing and he's playing much younger than
This is Tracy Wolfe, who gets an introducing Tracy Wolfe.
Oh, so she's going to be a big deal.
Opening titles. And she is a big deal within the Lethal Weapon franchise.
Oh, right, okay.
She's been in all the films.
Yeah.
Has
but
she?
But this is all very racially progressive, though, isn't it? That the white guy lives in a trailer, whereas the black guy is a family man in a nice house. Certainly for the 80s, this is quite ahead of its time, really. And the fact that race never gets mentioned in this film either. It's a really nice, refreshing take on this friendship.
I completely agree.
The trailer is supposed to be a negative thing, isn't it? That he's living in. Because also, that looks like a really cool place to live.
I was going
to
say, it's amazing.
I would love to live there, wake up and have a beer.
Me too. So,
is it wrong that his entire life is aspirational? I mean,
no.
You know, take out the dead wife, potentially. Although, you know, sometimes you do just need a break.
Every clown.
Have you seen the deleted scene where he picks up a sex worker?
No.
Yeah, there's a deleted scene where he picks up a girl. He asks her how old she is and she says she's like 21 or something. He says, how old are you really? She says, are you a cop? And he's like, no. And she says, I'm 16.
Oh, no.
And he pulls out his police ID and says, look, he pulls out money. He says, look, I'm going to give you $100. All you got to do is come back to mine and watch TV with me. And she says, what? And he wants her to come back and watch the Three Stooges with him.
Right.
And sit next to him and watch the telly like his wife used to do.
Gross.
It's really grim.
Yeah.
So I don't want everything in his life.
I don't want to do that.
Isn't it weird how hiring a sex worker to do that is somehow weirder than hiring a sex worker to have sex with?
With
it's sort of more depressing and more like weird. Yeah.
It's a trope that you see quite a lot when someone's, you know, they just want to hug or they just want to be touched. They don't want to actually have sex with someone or with a sex worker, but they can't do that any other way. So they just buy it. You see that quite a lot.
Fetch my dick that I left in the bath.
Would you please? But this is the thing about trailer. Like, sorry to go off on a tangent, but I love a caravan in holiday and now I'm not allowed to go on them because Mark thinks they're like low rent. Mm. So we never go in caravans. Whereas I spent my whole youth in a caravan. So when I saw that trailer, I was like, I completely agree with you. It just felt safe. I didn't live in a trailer before you.
No, I don't know. But you don't just get a brochure or some kind of catalogue to show Mark. There are some high end caravans.
Oh my!
I've tried.
Like, we could, you know, we can have our own bedroom. Mm. We don't have to sleep on that flip down thing in the whatever. But he won't do it. But it's snobbishness. We used to have a camper van, and apparently that's fine. But the minute it can't move, he doesn't like it.
Right. And also, when I said brochure or catalogue, you could just use the internet. Modern people.
Anyway, so what we need to do is establish how crazy Riggs is. So there's a scene here where he tries to buy $100,000 worth of Christmas trees. No, I'm kidding. Cocaine. So that's just to establish he's a live wire, but he's funny with it. But we move quite quickly from that scene.
In that scene, he eats the cocaine, doesn't he?
Yeah, he tries a little bit.
He tries a bit.
It's quite a lot he eats, though. I just wonder, what would that do to you, eating a big lump of cocaine?
Oh, listen to the ingenue in the corner. What would that do? I mean, I can't imagine.
I've never heard of anyone eating it, though. What happens when it goes in your nose.
Well, no, but the thing is, if you... But if you taste it, you can, like, it going in your nose, it can still be cut with other things that give you the same high as cocaine, like Novocaine or something. But tasting it, if you know cocaine, it will taste different. It will taste like it's cut. So that's why you put it in your mouth or rub it on your
gum. So but it'll have the same effect putting a...
Yeah.
It's a big lump he puts in there. So no wonder he's acting like the Three Stooges.
Mm. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, I agree. I mean, but I think he'd do that anyway.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway.
He's not a man who you'd want to hang out with on coke.
Oh, no. I wouldn't even want to go for half a lager with him, to be honest.
How many guns do you have?
But we move from the Christmas tree scene to...
Are you skirting over all of the whole my wife can't cook stuff? Because pretty much all my notes are every time...
You go for it.
I'm just saying that we start off where there's the whole dropping the egg on the floor at the start.
Yeah.
Mrs. Murtong drops the egg on the floor, which now, when we get into the number of times this comes up, I don't want to say that I'm basically saying she is a bad cook and that it's fine what they do, which is constantly reference what a bad cook she is. No one bats an eyelid when she drops that egg, not even her. She drops an egg and just carries on, which makes me think it happens a lot, which makes me think that perhaps she is a shit cook. If she just has another egg lost.
It makes me feel a bit sick, though. Like, an egg on the floor is so upsetting to me. And this, I'm jumping ahead, but I don't care. There's a scene later where, what's he called? Bruni gets shot with the helicopter thing. He's drinking eggnog from a carton. And I thought I was going to be sick in my mouth. That makes me feel violated. Horrendous.
Yeah. The egg on the floor, is that because...
Well, it's very slippy, for a start. It's dangerous.
It's nothing to do with you being a mother. Sort of life, like the loss of life. It's like not even being eaten by someone. So that could have been a baby. And
a baby chicken.
A baby chicken. Still a baby. I know what I'm doing here is sort of trying to separate your motherhood from your hatred of living creatures.
Oh, right. Sorry. Is that what you're doing? God, no. No, it's just slippy and weird.
Right.
And an egg on the floor looks weird and upsetting.
Okay.
And I don't think she's a bad cook. I think she should, you know, keep her house in order and clean that home.
But he does say to her, she's like, I'm thinking of going on Jeopardy. And his first response is, don't pick any questions about cooking.
Oh, right. Okay. Okay, now you've distracted me. Where am I up to? Okay, anyway, this is a bigger scene than that. Stop going on about eggs and cooking. It's not important.
All right.
The important scene next is that Riggs tries to kill himself, but doesn't. That's an important scene.
He's so good in that scene.
He's really good. And now it's so much longer than I remember it being. Like, and it's really uncomfortable and very...
The only bit I'm not sure about in that scene is the indecisiveness between head and mouth.
Whoa, why?
I think you should know. I think it's a great scene and I think he's brilliant, but he's got it against his head. He's like, you want him to be just thinking about whether or not he's going to do it.
Yeah.
Not whether or not he's going to use his head or his mouth.
But isn't that to show that he, because there's a scene with Murtaugh later where he's like, you'll get it wrong. It will go through your cheek. So he's realised that he has to do it a different way for it to work.
You'd assume Riggs would know that because he's
would,
such
he's
a super badass.
Killer. Yeah, he's a trained killer.
You've skipped over our meeting of Dixie.
Oh, yeah.
We do meet Dixie. She plays a sex worker.
Mm-hmm.
Not her most famous sex worker role, the actress, Lycia Naff.
Such rich pickings, weren't there, in the 80s for female actors?
But you'll love her most famous sex worker role.
Tell me.
Dixie, the actress who plays Dixie,
yeah,
also plays Mary, the triple-breasted prostitute from Total Recall.
Oh, really?
sex worker from Total Recall.
You're so Partridge. I say that all the time. You really can be very Partridge sometimes.
Martian tits.
I wish I had three hands.
Oh, dear. But this, so this is what I'm saying about the script sometimes doing a bit of show and a bit of tell, which I understand, but if we've had the show, we don't need the tell. So Riggs has tried to kill himself and doesn't do it, and it's a very moving scene. And then you go almost immediately to a very on-the-nose psych evaluation where the precinct psychiatrist, psychologist, whoever she is saying, he's on the edge, he'll attempt suicide. And it's like, we know, we just saw it.
What's interesting about that is the captain... appears to be, because he becomes like a great friend and ally of Riggs and Murtaugh over the course of the franchise. But in that scene, he seems to be suggesting that Riggs is faking it to create to claim a psych pension, which I think is interesting because that's his only appearance in this movie and he's a much bigger character in the rest of the franchise.
Yeah, I like the. My favourite line in this is she says, his wife of 11 years died. So the suggestion being, if they'd only been married 10 minutes, he's not allowed to be sad.
It's not as sad.
Do you not think?
Yeah.
But it's still his wife. I don't know. I just found that a bit like, just cut the man some slack.
They do kind of pitch the psychotherapist as a villain in this film, though. Mm. When actually, she said exactly the right thing. This guy should not be out in the field.
True, yeah.
She gets short shrift as the series goes on
She does.
But
she's in love with Riggs, isn't it? Yeah.
They turn her into a real punching bag.
Yeah.
But in terms of like setting up Riggs, after we've set up all this, then we get the big exposition chat, don't we, in the car park when they're walking to the car, where we learn that he's a kick-ass shot, a sniper, knows martial arts, did assassinations in Vietnam, should be registered as a lethal weapon.
Oh, nice. Yeah, I put that in red.
Yeah.
I love it when they say their title.
I mean, that's the thing with that scene. There's a lot of gun banter, which made absolutely no sense to me because I don't know anything about guns.
Well, a hollow point, that'll make sure that definitely kills you.
Why? Because of lethal weapon.
Lethal weapon.
Yeah, that's fair enough. But the point of the scene is obviously to establish, you know, you've got your duo together, but they've got conflicting paths. So Murtaugh wants an easy life and Riggs is capable of anything, which would upset the easy life option, which is brilliant, you know, to blend those two things.
Yeah. Riggs has the more interesting character. It appears.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously they complement each other, but you've got this guy whose wife has died. He's got a death wish, but he's so fucking good at his job.
Yeah.
And then you've got Roger, who's a bit tired, a bit old, and hates his wife's cooking.
And hates his wife's cooking.
He's Ernie Wise, and Riggs is Eric Morecambe. Mm-hmm. Like, you've got to have the straight man. You've got to have the funny man.
And the script does a brilliant job of you've got enough of both of them because you do care about Murtaugh making it through the day, even though he's saddled with this lunatic. But if it was just too much lunacy, you would be fatigued with it after a while. Like, you wouldn't care.
Danny Glover is there to react, and react he does.
Sure does.
He reacts big and large and strong and powerfully.
But then the next scene that I think we should talk about, which I think is the key scene in this film, is the do you really want to jump scene. Would you like to talk about that?
I would. Just before that scene...
If this is about cooking, I'm going to get mad, but go on.
It's not. Did you see what was playing at the cinema behind them when they are walking to the suicide jumper? It is The Lost Boys.
Is it?
The Lost Boys is on at the cinema. I got really confused.
Oh, no, it's because of Richard Donner, isn't it?
It's because they're both Warner Brothers movies. And so even though this came out before Lost Boys, so I just went, how is Lost Boys on at that cinema? Because I'm an idiot. I was like, how is Lost Boys on at that cinema? It wasn't out at this point. And it's a little advert within the movie.
Any opportunity. Mm. Yeah. So the do you really want to jump scene? Riggs and Murtaugh are sent to talk down a jumper. Riggs, very cocksure, bowls onto the roof. So here we've got a man who we know wants to commit suicide coming to the rescue of a man who we know wants to commit suicide. Excellent. Good setup.
Yeah.
Yes. Riggs greets him, says Merry Christmas, which is good because it's disingenuous and therefore it's odd and it's very funny. But then obviously with the setup that you know of Riggs, because he hasn't got any fear, so he's not scared of death because he doesn't kill himself, but he's not scared enough of death in the way that a normal person is. He gets on the ledge and then he uses empathy to sort of connect with the jumper and then says, which is a really important line, it's not like you're murdering anyone. Like, well, I get it. You've done nothing wrong. It's not like you're murdering anyone. And then promptly, more or less, handcuffs them together. So now you've got, does the suicidal man want to be a murderer or does he still care enough about consequences? And other people, which is what your script is asking you to ask of Riggs at that point. So the characters are mirrored, which is excellent. They argue. The jumper calls Riggs a psycho and then says, fuck you, I'm going to jump. And then Mel Gibson does his full I'm really batshit mad impression, which is, do you really want to jump? But then as the audience at that point, if you haven't seen it before, you are gripped because what you've seen is a man perform a bluff and has it massively backfired. And then Riggs makes them jump, making the man realise he didn't want that all along. And then they land on the inflatable. I've called it a safety mat, but I don't actually know what that is.
A crash mat?
But a crash mat isn't inflatable, or is it?
I think you can have a variety of crash mats.
From your history as a gold-winning gymnast.
A gold medallion-winning gymnast. Yeah.
A gold gymnast.
Yeah. And obviously, you know, I worked in a gym for a long time. So
you didn't.
So. Why his arms are so big.
That's why, I mean, I worked in a gym until it was proved that I couldn't do press-ups because of my...
You didn't work in a gym.
My dense bones. No, I didn't work in a gym.
All right.
Mickey.
What? I would have liked to have known why this guy wanted to jump. Personally, I would have liked a little bit, like, because you have to basically make up your own idea of why you think he wants to jump. And the only thing you can base it on is his appearance. And I think it's his hair. I honestly think it's the 80s. Bad hair was everywhere. His hair is so high but I think he's in constant pain from the weight on his neck.
That wasn't bad hair then.
I think it was.
That was good hair then.
I think even within the confines of 1987, he's got terrible hair and he's blown all his money on gel.
And they say he's a salesman, so that's why he's doing it. There's something gone wrong. Something's gone wrong.
Yeah.
Interestingly, there was another scene that introduced Riggs that got cut from the film. Have you seen this, where he goes to a school? So there's
a
bloke.
Bad idea.
There's a bloke at a school shooting children.
What?
Yeah. So it's grimly ahead of its time. That scene is really and so all the police are waiting for backup for the SWAT team to arrive. Riggs gets there and just walks straight up to in front of the bloke. The bloke's up on high and he just stands there and the guy starts shooting at him and he can't hit him. And Riggs just takes out his gun and takes the guy out and then he's walking away. And then some of the lines are a bit on the nose. A cop who's running past him goes, you're a dumb psycho son of a bitch, but you're good.
You're a lethal weapon.
It's a really good scene, that scene, because he sort of gets there and there's a sniper and he's like, it's the SWAT team on its way? And they're like, we don't have an ETA yet. And he's like, well, there's not a lot I can do if it's a sniper, so I'm going to go. And it's only when, like, one of the cops carries, like, a wounded child past him who's screaming that he goes, all right, I'm going to have to step up. But he does ask some pertinent questions, which makes you go, he's not just, like, just crazy. Because he sort of goes, he says to them, how good a shot is he? How's he firing? How long has it taken to reload? Have you seen the weapon? So he's not just risking everything. And when he walks up, the guy just opens fire on him, but misses every time because of the information Riggs knew beforehand.
Okay.
And a little bit of luck.
But I don't think it's necessary. I can see why they cut it, because this scene does a good job of telling us similar things about Riggs.
I would say this scene does such a good job that I would lose the Christmas tree stuff, because all you need to establish is that Riggs is nuts and Murtaugh needs to see it, and we don't actually need the Christmas tree stuff.
Agreed. And this plays a big part in the trailer, but this is one of those scenes where this could have been the trailer.
Yep.
You could have just put this scene in cinemas, put Lethal Weapon at the end of it, and people would have gone to it because it gives you exactly what the film is, and it's really exciting and it's funny and it's invigorating and it's like, this is Lethal Weapon.
Yeah.
It's the reason that you can't lose the Christmas tree scene, though, and I will agree that it's not very clear, but he's in narcotics at that point and he loses his position in that department to become Merton's partner because of that Christmas tree scene.
So what? You don't need to see it.
Do you not?
No, you don't. The important beat is that he'll do anything. He's nuts. If he loses his job and ends up in one department, you can be told that in five seconds. I know show don't tell, but to save 5 minutes and not to repeat the beat, I would, Shane, if you're listening, cut it.
How you doing?
How you doing? Listen, what are you doing for Christmas? So then that establishes Murtaugh knows what Riggs is capable of. Interestingly, he's the guy that can get the job done because of how he is. So that's something that will come in handy later. There's that weird scene. I find it weird. It's the brinkmanship between them about, is he really going to kill himself?
It's great.
It's good. It's powerful. And it's very gripping. Mm. But I felt like it was just a repetition of something I already know. So,
But the bit where Riggs pulls the trigger, and it's only because Murtaugh has his thumb in the, I don't know the gun terminology, but the cock, let's say.
I bet it's no, not Cock.
You called it, you cock a gun.
You do.
Anyway, he fires and Murtaugh's... he's got his finger in his cock. He's
have
got his dick in the bath.
From the plug hole. God, what a friend.
But, like, Riggs kills himself. As far as he's concerned, he's pulled the trigger.
Okay.
And he doesn't know that Murtaugh's finger is there to stop it. So I think that reestablishes straight after the suicide scene that, no, like, he's not just using it as, like, his death wish is real.
Yes, agreed. Okay, let's talk more about death wishes after a short break.
This week on Stakhanov.
Between the Lines with Melissa Reddy releases a brand new episode exploring the hot topic of head injuries in football. As well as exploring the sport's link with dementia with neuropathologist Dr. Willie Stewart, Melissa spoke to ex-Tottenham star Ryan Mason, who was forced to retire after a devastating head injury aged 26.
I couldn't look at light. I was sleeping for like 20 hours a day. I couldn't really hold a conversation. Like I say, when the brain gets an injury, the body almost just instinctively responds and it almost just shuts everything else down.
Meanwhile, self-care club Wellness Road Tested have launched a brand new epilogue show. Join Lauren and Nicole every Friday where they'll be hearing about your experiences, talking to the experts and reading the very best wellness literature in the self-care book club.
I think it's a totally life-changing book for sisterhood and womankind. It's revolutionary in how to adopt self-love and live for who you are.
Search Between the Lines and Self Care Club on your favourite podcast player.
All that and more at Stakhanov.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Okay, so this section then is about bringing Riggs and Murtaugh together, and there's a bit of plot about this sort of crime business that's going on, which takes a huge backseat to their friendship together, as proven by the scene where they go to, I keep calling it the swimming pool house scene.
Yeah.
There's a section of the script that goes around on the internet about why Shane Black is such a good writer, which is his scene description of this swimming pool house and the famous line where he sort of breaks the fourth wall of script reading, which is, it looks like a great place to have sex, the kind of place I'll buy if this movie is a big hit.
Yeah.
Very cheeky. And something that I find irksome, but because it's him, it's fine.
Yeah, you've said this before, because I read that and I was like, shit, that's how you should really sell a script.
You need to be so good.
Right.
It's on every page. Alex is making a personal comment.
Because it's so... I know it's ridiculous, but it vaults the... You know, there's a position of privilege when you're reading the script and the position of, like, powerlessness because someone's written it. You have the power in that moment. Is it a pass or not?
Yeah.
And to vault over that and be like, hey, hey, wink, wink.
But it's where he even sort of acknowledges the person reading it directly and says, a super smart script reader like I'm sure you are will already know that.
But if you're not, you just have to be so good because you just be like, oh, stop it. But anyway, you know, he's good enough. I mean, plenty good enough. So when they get to the swimming pool house, the point of this scene is that Riggs is going to save Murtaugh's life, but there isn't a clue that they pick up to further the mystery. They just get shot at, and the point is one of them is now has saved the life of the other. Do you know what I mean? They're not like, oh, because we've been here, we know this kind of thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll be completely honest with you. I got a bit lost with the plot in Lethal Weapon at times.
Me too.
What's going on? I think the problem is that the bad guys don't show up or at least after they show up, they're then absent for a huge part of this film, like longer than feels acceptable as we learn about Riggs and Murtaugh and them forming this bond. You are going, right, okay, but now I've got their bond. They've got a bond. I get it. Yeah. Now give them something to sort of fight with this new bond that
yes,
they have.
Agreed.
Like,
yeah.
Bring in General McAllister. Where's Gary fucking Boosie?
Yeah.
Bring him back.
Yeah, the baddies aren't in it enough.
Yeah, and although that swimming pool death is, I still find it really disturbing.
It's really scary because of the plastic sheeting.
That's
so scary.
Mm, yeah.
Why is it covered with plastic sheeting anyway?
To stop leaves and... Do you not own a pool? To stop leaves and...
I live in a caravan. I don't know.
Debris. The sea is your pool.
Nature is my gym while we're at it.
Yeah, but it's awful. Although I would argue there's a really futile sort of rescue attempt. He's just been shot three times in the chest.
Yeah.
And then he falls into the pool and they're like, oh, he might drown. And they drag him out and go, nope, the bullets killed him.
Yeah. Yes, that's a good point. So he's dead and we sort of clear up that Murtaugh believes that's kind of the end of the mystery because all the bad guys, it was that bad guy that sort of did the drugs thing and he's responsible for Amanda's death, which takes place in a conversation that Riggs and Murtaugh have after Riggs has been over for dinner and they're on the boat in the driveway, chilling out, having a beer and having a drink. I think the point of this is that, what's his daughter's name?
Rhianne.
So she comes out and she, Danny Glover and her have a bit of back and forth, but she got caught smoking weed in the house and he's telling her off about that. And she's like, you're allowed to drink beer on the driveway. Why am I not allowed to do this? And it's just to show a bit of father and daughter like back and forth. But I did think, and I like this a lot, there's meant to be a parallel running with Amanda and the idea that, and fathers and daughters, and that daughters, that's what starts with a bit of weed ends up with earrings and no bra and a high dive off a building because of drug misuse. Do you not think?
Yeah. Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I was more fascinated with the fact that there's a bit about her cooking.
Oh, God.
No, because it's a good bit, this bit, because he's slagging off her cooking in front of Riggs. And she actually does say to him, Mrs. Murtaugh says to him, you're being an asshole, Roger, which I think is nice.
Well, he's showing off, isn't he? He's showing off in front of his new friend.
Exactly.
But that moment they share on the boat, I think, although it doesn't, as you say, it doesn't really further the plot in any way, I feel like it's one of those moments where the film comes to life. I think those scenes are why this film had a bunch of sequels.
Right,
it's because of that friendship. It's because we didn't focus on the villains or the plot.
Well, it's not the plot, is it? Because it's not the world's most exciting, like, whodunit or...
We like spending time with these two guys. And so by putting in... And those films became all about those moments.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. What was nice, though, was over the course of the sequels, watching Roger's house expand. Because he's got a boat on the driveway in this one, but then he's got a whole extension in one of the later ones. It's really cool. It does become... The Lethal Weapon series, watched back to back, is really good fun because it is like a soap opera with a lot of shooting.
And then so we've got more scenes where we see Riggs and Murtaugh together again. So they go to the shooting range. And that's a bit of dick waving about who's best at shooting a bit of paper.
Well, we get a little bit of plot development here because, weirdly, for a family that like to raid the bathroom and see Roger in the bath at any opportunity, he then opens his birthday presents on his own, which seems like a really strange thing to do.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
But one of those is the evidence.
Yes.
The video cassette, Amanda and Friends.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
Yeah, which a pornographic video, which he then proceeds to watch in the living room.
Yeah, but I just think it'd be all right.
TV.
Yeah, but it could be.
Where else,
like,
could he watch it? It's like 1986.
But he looks sad. He doesn't look like, oh, little perk. Like, he does look sad, doesn't he? Like,
yeah.
Oh, yeah.
He did, yeah, of course he does look. He does look sad. I mean, did he know it was porn when he put it in? I'm not sure. Amanda and Friends to me sounds like a Nickelodeon show. It doesn't sound like porn. It sounds like the kind of time you get caught out by sort of going, ooh, in the night garden. What's that?
Whoa, hey! I'm just saying. Back off! I was watching
Pinky
that.
And Perky.
Dolls.
I'm just saying. Macca Packer.
Why do you know so much about the night garden? Anyway, whose kids have you been?
Because I went into a rental shop and I went, I'd like something sexy. And I got conned in the night garden. It does
sound it's not sexy.
Pretty sexy, no.
Did you audition for In the Night Garden?
That's a sheepish smile, did
what?
You?
What on earth are you talking about?
Did he?
Yeah, when I lost my job at the gym. I auditioned for In the Night Garden.
I haven't seen you for a bit. It's like I've forgotten everything about you. It's so weird. Right, anyway.
The shooting range is cool.
The shooting range is cool. It goes on a bit long.
Yeah, and also Tackleberry, I remember him doing it in Police Academy 6, City Under Siege, which he sort of does it better.
Yeah.
But that was when the rot really set into the Police Academy series.
So Dixie's house blows up, which enables Riggs and Murtaugh to interrogate a six-year-old for ages.
And puts them on Mr. Joshua's radar.
Yeah, but I think there's a mistake here, which is Murtaugh goes in to talk to the kid because he's a family man. He's kind of like, I've got this. So why is he not then sort of usurped by Riggs being like, we haven't got time for this shit, and just doing the thing that he does, which would be to scare the kid and like make him tell. But he doesn't. He just sort of leans on the fire truck thing in the background and waits for this child to tell them what they need to know.
But that tattoo moment, it gives me goosebumps still, where the kid just goes, it looked exactly like that, and points at his special forces tattoo.
Oh,
I liked it.
They also use a Dad's Army joke, which is don't tell him your name, Alfred. Don't tell him your name, Pike.
Yeah.
It gets a bit political. Mama says policemen kill black people.
Yeah.
Yes.
The kids are brilliant there. I think they're really funny.
They're
those
really
kids.
Cute, yeah. And funny. Yeah. Yeah, a good team.
There is some outdated dialogue when Murtaugh is trying to put out Riggs's coat on the lawn of Dixie's house.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So then the plot just goes bananas. So Gary Busey shoots someone from a helicopter at a funeral while they're holding a carton of eggnog, which is not a minor.
So this is Michael Hudsaker, Amanda's dad, who decides to take a meeting in a room perfectly designed to be killed by a dude in a helicopter.
At a funeral.
you've got to imagine, if you're working in a dangerous industry, the glaziers, when they were putting in those windows, must have said, just that we have to ask this. We have to ask this. But do you think there's any chance in the future you will be killed by a guy in a helicopter? Because bullets go right through these. They just go right through them.
You should be warned.
Whether or not you're drinking eggnog, they're just going to go. They're going to go right through these.
Oh, I was obsessed with it. I was like, do you think it's warmed? I just, oh, like his hands had warmed.
Do you really hate eggnog?
I really, really hate it. Yeah, okay. I really hate it. I've got a horror of it. Because it's like the thing that aunties always have, but it's like, you know, some aunties or elder relatives, they won't get rid of stuff past its sell-by date. And there's always a bottle of Advocar just mildewing on the sideboard. And that's the only booze. So when you go around, you're fucking dying for a drink. But it's like eggnog or nothing. And then it's like, how much do I want to drink? A lot. Yuck. Just yuck. And I've never seen it in a carton.
Don't you call it a snowball?
Yeah. What? Why Nothing. Are you laughing?
My mind, the first reference point I have for snowball is something different than it should be. And I don't want to say it. So I think we should just move on.
Right.
If you want to know what it is, watch Clerks. Where it came from.
I know now.
There you go. Sorry.
I didn't mean to. How to make something bad worse.
So Riggs is this, moving on, kick-ass special forces guy.
Yeah.
He is super well-trained. He knows everything. He's an assassin.
He can make shots that only 8 out of 10 people, 8 or 10 people in the world can make.
Right. Yeah.
Since he was 19 years old.
There's about 8 guys in the world who could have made that shot.
That he made in now.
Right. So he's got all of that. But there is one weakness, which is that he can't hear a helicopter approaching that is massive despite standing outside about 10 metres from it. Because it's not like, it literally just comes up from behind the cliff and he's like, oh, fucking hell. You had one job. Don't let him die. Look out for helicopters.
Yeah. Are they in the desert? Where are they? They're in the desert, aren't they?
That's later.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah, yeah, you're right. So I'm talking about Murtaugh's daughter being kidnapped and we've got the sort of sharpshooter in the desert scene.
End of Seven vibes. I got to that sequence.
Yeah, that's a good point. Mm. And inexplicably, they're not shot on the spot. Like, I lost the thread of the plot. Like, they're like, don't kill Murtaugh for some reason. Get Riggs and we'll go to... And I like the torture scene, but it's like, let's keep them alive for some reason.
Can we not call this the worst thought through plan in the world? From the minute it starts, I just do not see what their plan was. It seems like we want to do this cool thing in a desert, so we're just going to go out there. Was Riggs meant to kill all of the bad guys and then Roger and his daughter just were going to escape? Because then it's scuppered because Riggs doesn't tell Roger not to stand in the fucking way. He's like, oh, shit, move left.
Move left.
Give him a little tiny transistor radio in your ear because the mobile phones in this look portable.
Although you do get a helicopter chasing a big limo type.
Yeah. Thing,
and that looks, it still looks amazing.
That's cool. And we've got a homoerotic relationship building here between Riggs and Mr. Joshua.
Yeah. He claims that he ran into him and his company back in 69 in Vietnam. Mel Gibson would have been 13 years old then when he was a sharpshooter. None of the ages make sense. He's playing 38 in this film when he was 30 at the time. So none of the ages make sense in this movie.
Because he said that he was 19 in this time and he would have been a baby.
Yeah.
He also says the second time Mr. Joshua shoots him through the shop window and Murtaugh goes, was it him? And he goes, yes. And he says the line, I never forget an asshole.
He's good though, isn't he, Busey here? I talk a lot about how this kind of film only really works if the villain's good.
Yeah.
He doesn't get much screen time, but he does a lot with that screen time. It's very memorable, him burning his, burning his arm.
It's stupid. But
it's memorable.
Yeah, but it's so stupid. It's like, why would...
Something you can go and try in the playground afterwards, which is all kids want.
Yeah, good point.
It's the bit where he does it, and then he goes, yeah, you better go get that looked at. He's your second in command.
Take a week off, to be honest. That's going to really sting. You're fired, Joshua.
You
can't use that arm.
You're not going to be able to fire a gun. I fire a gun with accuracy for months.
Why did I do that again?
Really get that look. Go straight away. Can someone call 911?
Boss, why do you keep burning our guys?
That's the thing. I'd forgotten that.
That's the third Mr. Joshua this week.
I thought it was going to be like, you see, his skin doesn't melt. But it does melt, same as anybody else's. So we get to the torture scene. Why has that made you laugh?
It's just the way it's introduced. It's supposed to sound really like, menacing. When Mr. Joshua goes, Endo has forgotten more about dispensing pain than you or I will ever know. But it just makes it sound like, but he has remembered some. No, right?
Otherwise, this is going to be so easy.
He's retained some information. Because otherwise, it's just going to be like you in a shower for a bit with him rubbing you with a sponge.
With a scouring pad, yeah. Is there something... Because I like the torture scene, I like all of that, but Mel Gibson is being rubbed down with a scouring pad and has Danny Glover just been... Has he just got salt being poured on him?
Like, I think it's lye, isn't
it? Oh, fuck. All right, that's awful, obviously, but... It's very like homemade torture, like torture for beginners. Like if you're short of equipment, you may have something in the under sink cupboard that can help you with this.
And also, like we've established that Gary Busey basically goes, Endo knows more than me about torturing or you, but mainly me. And then the minute Endo starts torturing him, Gary Busey does not let him do it. He's a backseat torturer. He's like, hit him again. Do it again. Push him this way. I've got to electrocute him myself.
Was that in the script or do you think Busey just did that?
Yeah. But do you think they pulled back in the script because there's no blood, there's no like removal, there's no sounds, like torture scenes, I always find very difficult because I'm scared of torture.
Scene got cut. And I'm not going on the record here, but I just seem to remember there was a longer version of this scene, right. I think, yeah.
Because there's no, like, cracking noises, crunching, whatever. It's electricity, and obviously that must hurt, but it doesn't, to watch, it's not too gory. So it's quite palatable, weirdly.
Now, am I right in thinking all of this torture happens in the basement of a nightclub that the mercenaries also run.
Of course.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Good, but not sort of, it doesn't seem to be a commercial nightclub. It seems to be a sort of rock and roll nightclub.
They never are, though, are they? It's just for band practice, isn't it?
Like the band that's on at the start is sort of like very alternative.
Well,
like,
it's on Sunset. They're on Sunset Strip, though, aren't they? Which was quite a rocking place back in the 80s.
True.
It's quite different.
True.
Where Guns N' Roses got their start.
Yeah.
That's what I thought of when I was watching it.
Yeah. Do you know what show Blur gave their first ever TV performance in the UK on?
No.
Eggs and Baker.
Is that true?
True, yeah.
Are you being serious?
No, they really. Blur's first television appearance was on Eggs and Baker performing.
Is that in your notes? Or is that from your brain?
It was when I was researching Eggs and Baker for this episode.
What's Eggs and Baker? Have I missed this?
Eggs and Baker, we were talking about at the start. Cheryl Baker. From Butts Fizz hosted a children's cookery show on Saturday mornings called Eggs and Baker.
Mm.
Okay. It's not movies. That's probably why you're a bit confused.
No, I'm a big Baker fan.
Right, okay. Okay.
That one, not this one.
I think it's a bit of a shame that Roger doesn't get to save his own daughter, but he does say, there's no more heroes left in this world, and then Riggs breaks down the door with the corpse of his torturer, and that is fucking amazing. You can't beat that, can you? So then we've got a bit of a chase, and then the big boss
chase, the chase that Shane Black wrote into The Last Boy Scout and The Nice Guys.
Yeah.
Where you kind of apprehend a villain with gunfire on an overpass bridge and then makes a jump. I mean, he just does it over and over again. It's mad to think how, and also sort of rewatching this, is how often he does the double act with one of them completely damaged.
Okay.
I think half of his films have used that as the through line. So, yeah, I guess write what you know or write what you're good at.
The best thing about the chase for me is I think this was the first time I'd ever seen an action hero really fucking pegging it on screen.
Yeah.
When Mel Gibson runs,
he's got such springy little legs, doesn't he?
He's really running.
He's really fast.
You see that sort of slow-mo or sort of like a very action movie run. This and then Bad Boys. Will Smith does it in Bad Boys as well.
Great runners.
Yeah. I think it's really important to feel that sort of velocity and like the intention.
Yeah, this is a really geeky script moment, but just hear me out, and I hope it's true, but in reading around this, so we know that Shane Black's final script for Warner Brothers was a bit different from the one that they bought, obviously having to go through like some development, and apparently, and I don't know if this is true, but they had a bit of a wobble, and they're like, look, this isn't what we signed up for. There was a turn of phrase he wrote, and I was reading this, I was like, I wonder if this is better be good, and it kind of convinced them that he, you know, he did have the goods, and he knew what he was doing during this car crash scene. And the turn of phrases and the cars trade paint. And when I read that, I was like, that's oh my God, I find that so sexy. I just find sexy as in like, it's accomplished, it's skilled. I get why you'd read that one thing and be like, you are rehired forevermore. Like, I love it. Is there something, I don't know. Do you know what I mean?
No, I like it as well.
It's gorgeous, isn't it? Like, it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. Anyway.
But because it makes you, I mean, to a script reader, I'm guessing, if it's a turn of phrase that you would never normally, it makes you go, this fucking guy knows his shit.
Yeah.
That's probably something that people say, like, who know about cars in car chases that I'm just not aware of.
It's just unusual. It's concise. It's visual. It's lovely. Mm. I was so jealous when I read that.
You know, he doesn't listen to the podcast, right? I just want you to know, it's just going out there into the ether.
Yeah, I know. Not yet.
Someone might
pass
it on to him eventually.
Anyway.
Do you want to trade paint, Shane?
Oh, no. It's not that kind of love I have for him.
Right, okay.
It's a mentor-mentee kind of relationship, I'd like to think. I mean, it could develop.
You know how they end up.
They do, don't they? Yeah. Frequently. There was a warm fire before I knew what I was doing.
Half of Love Actually, wasn't it?
Anyway. Yeah. So we're back at Murtaugh's home. Now, fine. His daughter's been kidnapped. They go home to sort of catch Gary Busey. I like all of this. I like them leaving a note for him that's like, what does it say?
Dear bad guys, no one here but us cops. Sorry, the good guys.
So the trouble for me is that it repeats the beat because we've already been to his house. And if that's where Act 3 is going to happen, the house should be sacred ground somehow. It should be like, oh my God, they've finally gone to my house. But we've already been there. So it's like, okay, I don't feel as scared for you as I would have done if this was like the first time. They drive a car through the front of the house just to sneak up on Gary Busey. I love it, but that is what happens. And then we get a highly sexed bare chest fist fight in the rain, in the mud.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of this fight. No. I feel like I'm a bit spent at this point, and you know that Riggs is going to win, and it goes on quite a long time, and I don't like the way it looks either. I find like the spotlight from the helicopter, like flashing across the camera lens, quite distracting.
Okay, I mean, I don't mind the fight. What I find, what stretches my incredulity too much, and I'm happy to suspend my disbelief, and you can drive a car through the front of your own house or whatever, is that Murtaugh has to say to the other police officers, like, this is my scene, this is my scene, stand back. He's kind of saying, this is now a state-sanctioned fight to the death. Because he represents law enforcement and he's saying, this is how we're going to do it. And that is not believable.
Because someone comes on the radio and goes, until a senior officer arrives, he is right.
It's ridiculous. It's so ridiculous. What if it goes wrong? Like, it doesn't. It should be. I understand that it can be covert and like the other police officers are on their way. But he's like, look, I will let you do this. But when they get here, we need to do it by the book.
Yeah. And it's a very schoolyard thing. Because everyone just gathers around and goes, fucking give it to him!
Fight!
Kick him!
Yeah, and he literally pushes other people out of the way, like, let them fight. must fight.
It was cool seeing Copiera for the first time, though.
Yeah.
I'd never seen that before. And I remember thinking this is one of the best fights I've ever seen as a kid, because it looked like they were really kicking the shit out of each other. I think the trouble is that some of these fight scenes that I loved in the 80s look really dated now because of what we've gotten... due to films like The Raid or John Wick, or, you know, that all these people have come in from China and Japan and taught us how to fucking kick the shit out of each other properly.
Yeah. Did you read about the martial art that they were taught? So they did capoeira, but they did, it's called Jailhouse Rock.
Isn't it fascinating?
Yeah.
It was a martial art that was basically adapted inside the penal system.
It's so scary.
In the US, which is... Or based, I think it was African martial arts was where it came from.
No, it was Elvis Presley.
Oh God, of course it was.
Yeah, but it's all about improvising. And but I couldn't work out, as I was reading about it, I couldn't work out whether this was a martial art that had been developed for sanctioned fights within the prison system, like where you were, I guess they have boxing matches, prison boxing matches, maybe?
I don't know.
Or whether it was like some sort of covert martial art that was like, if someone comes at you in the yard, you use Jailhouse Rock.
That was my reading of it, which made me more scared of it. The scariest fight scene I've ever seen was the Breaking Bad prison scene. Have you seen that? So Mr. White from the outside pays the right people, and I can't remember who he wants dead. He wants someone dead in prison. So everyone sharpens their toothbrushes. And as the man's walking down the corridor, they just puncture him. It's so scary.
Shit.
Like 50, with these sharpened whatever. And it's just the way, because it's just these tiny little dots on his torso. But because there's so many of them, it kills him. And it's just done brutally and quickly. It's really haunting.
And
terrifying.
Sexy.
That's not sexy. But that gives, because weirdly, this fist fight in the rain does go wrong and Gary Busey doesn't die. And so that gives us a moment that Riggs and Murtaugh can shoot him together.
It does. And obviously by this point, General McAllister, played by Mitchell Ryan, Mimi Driver's dad in Gross Point Blank.
Oh, yeah, that's nice.
I know. His death's quite good because he's sort of trapped with all his grenades in his car screaming to get out.
Yeah.
Pretty good death for him.
Yeah.
And Michael Hudsaker, you know, we talked about him on the podcast. He is Tom Atkins.
Yeah, Tom Atkins is a legend.
The Fog. Main guy in The Fog.
And the Monster Squad. He's a legend.
Oh, yeah, shit, of course.
Yeah, he's done a lot of great horror in the
80s. Yeah, I just didn't put it together. So it's Christmas. Riggs is now part of the family. He says a sort of goodbye to his dead wife. That's it. He's fixed. Mm. He's mended.
But yeah, Murtaugh will not let him leave Murtaugh alone to eat the world's lousiest Christmas turkey.
I can't believe that there's even a suggestion that he can't come in. Like, the daughter answers the door and he's clearly waiting to be invited in, and she's like, so if that's everything? And he comes running down the path after him, like, let him in. So we all know that the sequel to Lethal Weapon, so Shane Black wasn't involved after like half of two because he wanted to kill off Mel Gibson's character. And the studio went, no, and so fired him instead, or he was invited to leave. And there's meant to be a fifth one.
Yeah, I know. Richard, is it Richard Donner who's talking about at the moment?
Yeah, can Richard Donner still direct a film?
I have no idea.
Is it true? I saw a
Is he 50 plus? Because 50...
You're done.
Is he proved with this movie, after 50, you are nothing?
Is it true that the tagline for it... Because I saw a poster, but I didn't know if it was like fan art, and it just says, still not too old for this shit. Which I know it's cheap, but it's hilarious.
I think it's fan art. I don't think they've released anything yet, but that is good.
It's really funny. I hope they're paying attention. So should we do the bits?
Mm-hmm.
Alex, what was your best scene?
I was going to say that I feel like a bit of a dick picking this scene because it's not in the movie version I watched, but I believe it is in the director's cut. But then Chris mentioned it anyway. It's the sniper scene.
Okay,
it's so good. You can find it online if you haven't seen it. But it's just I think he's really good in it, Mel Gibson, and I think it's just the right balance of crazy and skillful, and it works really well. So. The Mel Gibson Riggs sniper scene that isn't in the main version.
What about you?
Yeah, I'm definitely picking a scene that's in the film.
That's a good call.
And I'm going to pick the scene that sets him up much better than the deleted scene that Alex just mentioned. So the jumper jump.
Yeah.
I just think it sums up the movie, and I think it's great Riggs and it's great Murtaugh you get in that scene as well. So it's got everything. Covers all the bases.
Yep, me too, for the exactly the same reasons.
Yeah, me three. That jumper scene there. What I'm thinking is probably pick one that's in the movie, so the jumper scene.
Whatever. Most valuable whatever, Chris.
So I initially had Danny Glover because of how good he is at reacting. And then I thought, what the fuck am I doing? Mm. Like, it's because he's reacting to someone who's really doing something special. But just interestingly, do you know who Shane Black wanted to play Murtaugh?
Bruce Willis.
William Hurt.
Really?
Really?
Who I just can't see as being as funny or good. But yeah, so I'm going with Mel Gibson because he's someone increasingly, as we've seen in real life, seems like he's on the edge.
Oh, yeah.
And so it's why he's right for this role. And he's what makes Lethal Weapon. So Mel Gibson.
Yeah. Yeah, but then it is uncomfortable, isn't it? Like with everything he's done in the last few years. Mm-hmm. It's a hard watch now. Yeah, okay. You.
Mel Gibson.
Okay. Well, see, I've stepped back from lauding Mel Gibson because I just wanted to. So I've gone with the character of Riggs because the idea of a man with nothing to lose, but he's quite light with it. That's the fact. He's funny with it. And I like that.
Would you have liked to see maybe William Hurt in the Riggs role? Would that have done it for you?
I'm not a William Hurt guy, so I don't want to see him anywhere near this film.
Chris, what would you change?
Every single woman in this film is a victim.
Yes.
So, you know, that wouldn't have been hard to fix. Give someone some agency and something going on. Give the daughter, you know, she can be involved in her own escape. So, yeah, just, you know.
Easy peasy.
So, and they do fix that later on in the series when René Russet joins the cast. But, yeah, that's just a problem with this one.
Yeah, not enough female victims for me. I really, really like to litter.
Are you sure about this?
Litter, no. A litter of film with them. No, mine is the line when they've just escaped from the nightclub. Riggs is chasing down Mr. Joshua. And Murtaugh is going to go after General McAllister. And he comes out and he's got Rhianne with him. And he's like, all right, I've got to go get General McAllister. And there's a beat cop who comes up to him. And Murtaugh says to him, get me some backup and take care of the girl. I'm just like, what? You mean your daughter?
Yeah.
Like, but
yeah.
I don't know why you'd not say at that point. So
take
I go,
care of you.
My daughter, who I thought was going to die literally 5 minutes ago, just take care of her. Unless he was basically saying, you don't know who my daughter is. So if I say, look after my daughter and you go straight to my house, and you don't realise this girl standing next to me is my daughter, I guess I should point out, I mean, this girl.
Okay. My change is use the bolt because Mel Gibson accidentally starts the bolt. There's a bolt on the driveway. Why not drive it down the street, chase it after someone, and let's get to some water, okay? Let's use the bolt. Why have we got a bolt on a driveway?
Drive the bolt through the front of the house at the end.
Oh, my God, of course.
There you go.
Yes. They try to do the car. The car won't start because Christmas, whatever. Drive the bolt through the house. Perfect.
Yep. Works for me. All right, that is Lethal Weapon done. Very quickly, take the time, if you would, to subscribe to us, rate, and indeed review us wherever you get your podcasts, Apple, Spotify, or other. It's a huge help, and we really appreciate it. Our Twitter is at ClashPod. Our Instagram is at ClashPod. That is us. We will be back on Thursday. You can't see this, but Chris is waving his finger at me like an old schoolmaster. What?
I slave over this quiz each week, writing questions for you all.
Do you know what? It's my own fault. I turned the page too quickly. There it is, written in black and white, quiz.
I've got a quiz for you. But I will say as well, we're doing this thing in January where we're going to do the films that you guys pick. We have had, as of recording this, 151 pairing suggestions have come in.
Brilliant. I say we do 6 months then.
So many good ones. So if you want to send your pairing suggestions in, which is show@clashpod.com.
Yeah, you like them on email, don't you?
Yes. So that's why I said that. Uh-huh. All right, we're going to do the quiz. I'm calling this. I'm going to string this out because Alex is eating cake. And I don't want him coming to the mic with a full mouth. I'm calling this the vanity quiz because this is about... This is about actors with music careers that are little more than vanity projects.
Okay.
And I'm going to give you an album, and you've got to tell me the actor who made the album, but it's going to be multiple choice. So say I said The Return of Bruno.
Mm-hmm.
Who released the album The Return of Bruno?
I don't know.
What are you talking about?
I thought you'd know that one. Bruce Willis released an album, The Return of Bruno.
Oh, really?
In 1988. Under the Boardwalk, went to number 2 in the UK charts.
So oh, yeah.
Quick question.
Yes.
So are we... What's happening?
I'm going to do it.
Are we guessing...
Stop it.
Are we guessing...
Stop it. Stop it. I'm going to give you the album title and then three actors, and you've got to pick which actor you think recorded the album. It's that simple.
Okay, Chris.
Songs from the Crystal Cave. Who recorded that album? Was it Jackie Chan, Jean-Claude Van Damme, or Steven Seagal?
Steven Seagal.
Jean-Claude Van Damme.
It was Steven Seagal.
Yes!
That came out in 2005, and the style can be described as outsider country meets world music meets Aikido.
Okay.
Bastard Life or Clarity. Who recorded that? Was it Oliver Reed, Russell Crowe, or Richard Harris?
Russell Crowe.
Oliver Reed.
It was Russell Crowe.
Oh, fuck's sake.
There are prizes for these quizzes now.
I know.
Right, yeah. There's a prize coming next week. Night Rocker. Who recorded Night Rocker?
Is that with a K or with an N? Mm.
David Hasselhoff.
Is it David Hasselhoff, Chuck Norris, or Mr. T?
It's David Hasselhoff.
It's David Hasselhoff. You both get it. That was that.
Are you keeping score as well?
I just want to make sure now there's a prize involved.
Oh, you're unbelievable.
That album featured three songs that appeared in an episode of Knight Rider. This person, the album is his name, followed by the words "sings cowboy favorites." So, who sings cowboy favorites? Was it John Wayne, Ronald Reagan, or Clint Eastwood?
Ronald Reagan.
I think it was Ronald Reagan.
It was Clint Eastwood.
No!
Famously bad singer as well.
Okay.
The Transformed Man. Was that William Shatner, Leonard Nimoy, or Charlton Heston?
Leonard Nimoy.
It was Shatner. Well done, Vicky. She's on the comeback trail. That's from 68. Features his famous cover of Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds.
Oh, I've heard that. Yeah.
No, it's not as good as his Common People. That's still the best. Yeah.
Dead Man's Bones. Was that River Phoenix, Ryan Gosling, or Keanu Reeves?
Keanu Reeves.
I think that was River Phoenix.
It was Ryan Gosling. You both got it wrong.
Was it really?
Two left.
I didn't know he even did music.
No.
The Futurist. Was that Robert Downey Jr., Eddie Murphy, or Jamie Foxx?
Jamie Foxx.
Surprisingly, it was Robert Downey Jr.
What?
Released in 2006, debuted at 121 on the US charts and featured a cover of Charlie Chaplin's Smile.
Oh, God.
Oh, when was this? This was old, Robert. This was around...
Not that old.
This was Chaplin time, Robert Downey
no,
Jr.
No, this was 2006.
Oh, okay.
A couple of years before Iron Man. Finally, The Crow. Who recorded The Crow? Was it Peter Sellers, Steve Martin, or Hugh Laurie?
Hugh Laurie.
Steve Martin.
Steve Martin!
Yes!
It's a tie!
Have you got a tiebreaker?
It's a tie. I have got a tiebreaker, kind of. So, we're jumping ahead to Die Hard. Who can name the most members, I'm going to go one to one each, of Hans Gruber's gang.
Oh, fuck.
Okay, all I'm right. going to start with you, Vicky, so that gives you a bit of an advantage.
Carl.
Okay, so stop.
Okay.
You get one.
Thank you.
Alex. Hold on, put the notes down. I don't know, they're written there.
They're down there. This is just me writing them down so I remember them. Theo.
You fucker. Put your notes down.
It's on that one there. Yeah. This is. No, I. She's doing.
All right, no,
checking.
I'm not. Right.
Theo and Hans Gruber, you can't have Hans Gruber. Okay. Theo's correct.
He's called. This is going to take ages because I really want to get this. Carl's brother. He just calls him brother. So, Bruder is brother.
Gosh, you can't have that.
No, I'm afraid not. If you can get one, Alex, you've won.
I could probably get two. I'm going for Christoph.
Correct, Christoph. Alex wins the tiebreaker.
And I would have also had Uli, Al Leong plays.
And you could have had Franco, Tony, Alexander, Marco, Eddie, Heinrich, Fritz, and James. Well played, Alex.
I'm annoyed about that. No, it's okay. You deserve it.
Thanks very much. I feel pretty good about that.
Yeah.
So where does that put us in terms of who gets this prize?
I'm not going to tell you until we get to the finale.
It's so tense.
All right. Well, I did my guff about how you can stay in touch with us. Chris told you about January. I won the quiz. That's the end of the show. We'll be back on Thursday to do Die Hard and reveal which of these two movies is our Christmas action movie champion. Speak to you then. Bye-bye.
This was a Stakhanov production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.